I'd like to read some excerpts from a book I've been working on for quite a long time, which is an effort that developed in the course of trying to treat this material to reintroduce fictional method to poetry. It's been used in a scattered way, but by and large, the poets have left scenes and fictional technique to the prose writers, and I think they've left out too good a thing. Chaucer had something going that 20th century lyric poetry has dropped off. Browning had his own way of getting it back, but by and large, though poems have told limited stories, they haven't tried to do what the short story is doing. This is a book to be published in May, and it's called Lives of X. And I suppose I didn't want to call them autobiographies, because they're lives of people I used to be once but have stopped being. It stops being auto. X is some unknown quantity, and it has had a number of lives and gone through various stages. And I didn't set out to develop a method, but in order to treat this material, I had to use devices that had fallen away from poetry. And I suppose some people will decide that I've gone dull, or maybe I've always been dull, because if one is going for lyrical intensity, he can write a certain kind of line. But if he is writing a scene, the scene has to have the structure, and the lines have to know how to relax as well as how to get tight. And that's the balance one walks. If you lose the balance, you fall off. And I'm not ready to say I haven't fallen off. This is the best I could do with them. This poem is called The Benefits of an Education, and the scene is Boston, 1931, as indicated in the subtitle. And there are perhaps two things I should explain. I lived in Medford. Having been born in Boston, we moved to Medford, which is a suburban town about 7 miles out. And on my way into Boston, during the Depression, a nickel was a lot of money. Everybody was squeezing a nickel one way or another, sometimes indecently. Charlestown was Irish town, and it was built on Bunker Hill, which is really Breed's Hill is where the battle was. Bunker Hill is the larger configuration. And there's a long, several miles slope down this hill in a straight line to where the elevated terminal is like a forest of girders rising out of a circle called Sullivan Square. And one of the manhood rituals of the young toughs would be to steal a car and ride the loop, which means you'd get going about 80 miles an hour or faster, and just plow down the middle of this street and hope the cops would chase you. And then when you got to Sullivan Square, you hoped you missed the girders, which wasn't easy to do because you had to dodge in and out of them. And then you would clear off toward Everett and junk the car and go back, and you were a big shot in the gang of savages, you see. Riding the loop was one of the madnesses of the times. I suppose it was like marathon dancing and this sort of thing. I think it's an impressive recollection because of the poverty of imagination that would make this a rich thing to do, though I suppose kids in the Midwest have been playing some fairly high-level games of chicken on the highways, which is another kind of poverty of the imagination. I mean, get yourself killed interestingly, at least. Not proving to some oaf that you're a bigger oaf than he is. And also at the same time, a phenomenon that has disappeared very largely. I recall around Boston they grew up a whole ring of rather ugly frame houses, and during the Depression people could not keep up the mortgage payments and the bank repossessed them. And when the house was foreclosed, they would put a red flag on it, meaning this house was for sale if you could pay the taxes and the back mortgage payments, and nobody could. And I recall walking down streets they seldom evicted anybody. It's better to have somebody in the house, even if he wasn't paying rent, than to have it empty and have the pipes freeze. But it was a rather dreary symbol of the time to find house after house with a red flag on it, you see. Somebody had made his investment and started to pay off the mortgage and lost his job and lost his house. And it was part of that miserable milieu. And here's the poem. One summer I had a job on an excursion fishing boat and fell in love with Boston Harbor. And one of the islands of the harbor, these were great glacial drumlins. When the glacier melted, it sometimes had a pocket full of dirt in it. And if there was enough dirt, it would make a hill. And some of these stuck up out of the water and would be islands. And then very rapidly, the tides eroded them and they disappeared. And one of the famous ones is the Nixie's Mate, because the mate of the bark Nixie back in colonial days was hanged for piracy. And he insisted that he was innocent. He was hanged on the island that was later named the Nixie's Mate, and he insisted that he was innocent, and the time would prove it because the island on which he was hanged would disappear. And it has all but disappeared. It's just the mud shallows now. And I guess he had watched the harbor and knew that these islands were going and wanted to make a metaphysical joke toward the end, because I suspect he was guilty. But it's nice to have observant criminals. A hulk, three-masted once, three-stubbed now, carried away by any history and dumped in a mud ballast of low tide, heeled over, and a third swallowed in the black suck south of the Nixie's Mate, itself going, gave me a seal of memory for a wax I wouldn't find for years yet. This was Boston. Men with nothing to do plovered the sand edge with clam rakes that raked nothing. I walked home over the drawbridge, skirting on my right Charlestown, ramshackled over Bunker Hill, and waiting for hopped-up kids to ride the loop and die in a tin rumple against the girders of Sullivan Square, or dodge away toward Everett and ditch the car, then walk home and be heroes to ingrown boyos, poor as the streets they prowled. There, house to house, the auctioneer's red flag drooped its torn foreclosure to no buyer. Now and then, a blind man who could see and his squat wife who could stare out at nothing sat on the curb by the stacked furniture and put the babies to sleep in dresser drawers till charity came or rain made a pulp of all. The rest lived in, guarding their limp red flags. The bank was the new owner, and that was all. Why evict nothing much to make room for nothing? Some sort of man is better than no man, and might scrounge crates to keep the pipes from freezing until the water co turned off the meter, or come election, when men got their dole, the bank might get the trickle of a rent that wasn't there. I'd walk those 7 miles from Medford to Tea Wharf to get my job on the King Philip. Well, not quite a job, but work, free passage, and a chance to scrounge nickels and fish all summer till school opened, Miss Bates and Washington Irving. The King Philip rose sheer, three riverboat decks top heavy, but she could ride an inner harbor swell and not quite capsize, though God knows she'd try. Excursion fishing. She put out at 9 from the creaking stink of Sicilian fishing boats, praying for gasoline they sometimes got, and came back in at 5. In any weather that might turn up a dollar a head half deck load, doling 4 quarters into the first mate's hand as if the fish they meant to eat were in it and not still on a bottom out past luck. Sometimes 100 or more, but of them all, not 20 would turn up with a dollar bill. It was all change. We call the first mate Jingles, waiting for him to walk across the wharf and spill his pockets into the tin box in the fish market safe. When he came back, his name was Dixon, and we could cast off. Your dollar bought you 8 hours on the water, free lines, free bait, your catch, and noon to one, all the fish chowder you could eat. Good days, the decks were slimed with pollock, cod, hake, haddock, a flounder or two, and now and then a skate. A sharp man with a sawtooth small tin can punch out foolish scallops from a skate's wing. A foolish scallop is a scallop for fools who eat it and don't know better. I made a scraper by screwing bottle caps to an oak paddle and went my rounds cleaning the catch for pennies or grabbing a gaff to help haul in the big ones. Dixon, jingling again, took up a pool, a dollar for the biggest cod or haddock, a half for the largest fish of any kind. No house cut, but the little he could steal and not be caught or being caught pass off as an honest man's mistake in a ripped pocket. The deal was winner take all, and the man that gaffed the winning fish aboard was down for a tip. One Sunday, with over 100 in the pool, I gaffed a skate we couldn't get aboard. Dixon boat hooked it dead, still in the water, then rigged a sling and tackle from rotten gear, and I went over the side and punched two holes behind its head. Then we paid out the hooks the firemen use for hauling cans of ashes to dump them overboard, and I hooked it on, and all hands hauled it clear to hang like a mat from the main to the lower deck. We couldn't weigh it, but it was no contest. Dixon paid on the spot. He counted it out to $57, and I got two. We took it into the wharf and let it hang, a flag. Till the next day when we cut it loose with half a ceremony, mostly of flies, just as we cleared Deer Island. The captain didn't want that shadow floating over his treasury of likely bottoms, so we let the current have it. After five, the fireman rigged the hose, turned on the pressure, and I washed down, flying the fish and fish guts out of the scuppers in a rainbow spray to a congregation of God-maddened gulls screaming their witness over the stinking slip for leavings. Fishermen are no keepers. One to eat, a few to give away, and that's enough. The scuppers might spill over, and the deck on both sides of a walkway might be littered with blue-backed and white-bellied gapers staring. I clean the best to haul home, or I did when I had carfare, or thought I could climb the fence into the L and ride free. Now and then, Gillis, who ran a market next to ruin, would buy a cod or haddock for nothing a pound and throw in a pack of camels. And half the time, an old clutch of black shawl with a face inside it and a nickel in its fist would flutter aboard like something blown from a clothesline near a freight yard, and squeeze a split accordion in her lungs to wheeze for a bit of any old fish left over, flashing her nickel like a badge and singing widowed beatitudes when I picked a good one and wrapped it in newspaper and passed it over and refused her ritual nickel the third time. I can afford to pay, son. Sure you can. Here now, it's honest money. Sure it is. Well, take it then. Compliments of the house. God bless you and your proud mother, she'd end and take the wind back to her line. Then the fish market man got after Dixon for letting me steal his customers. Nickels a nickels, for all he knew I might be stealing from him out of that pocket of nothing, but I foxed him. Next time the old shawl came, I sent her off to wait by Atlantic Avenue, and I'm damned if the fish market man didn't call to her, waving a flipper of old bloat, calling, cheap, just right for a pot of chowder. After that, I made an extra bundle every night, cleaned and filleted, and when she wasn't there, I fed the cats or anything else of God's that didn't run a market. Then, five nights running, she didn't come, which, in God's proper market, might be more mercy than all nickels are, whoever keeps the register, whoever folds old shawls for burial. Some nights, once, twice a week, or some weeks not, the ship was chartered for a stag by the VFW. We used to call them the victims of foreign whores. Or some lodge or some club, though the promoter was always the same stink and tired tout's tweed. He rigged a rigged wheel forward on the lower deck, sold bootleg by the men's room, used the ladies as an undressing room for the girly show that squeezed its naked, pinched companionway to the main deck saloon to do the split or sun itself in leers, clutching a stanchion, or when the hat was passed, to mount the table and play house, if not home, two at a time with a gorilla stinking of pomade who came in in a bathrobe from the ladies. Two shows a night, prompt as mind's death could make them while it still had a body. And on the top deck, for an extra quarter, Tilly, the artist model, undid her flickering awl on a canvas screen lashed to the back of the wheelhouse, where the captain kept a sharp Yankee watch for the harbor cruiser. He was a good gray stick of salt, hull down in some lost boyhood that had put to sea with the last whales still running into myth, and down to this, or be beached flat, keeled over like Boston, or that hulk off the Nixie's mate to stink in the mud for nothing. Nevertheless, it was some education in some school. I panted at those desks of flesh flung open, did mountains of dream homework with willing Tilly, and mornings ran a cloth and a feather duster. God knows where it came from. I'd guess Mrs. Madden, who cooked the daily chowder of leftovers in her throbbing galley, over the counters, chairs, and the great art-built table, still flesh-haunted. If it wasn't an education, it was lessons and something I had to know before I could learn what I was learning. Whatever there was to learn in the stinking slips and cat and rat wet alleys off the black girders and the slatted shadow of the Atlantic Avenue L in Boston, where the edge-grinding wheels of nothing screeched something from hell at every sooty bend. I took home more than I brought with me of all Miss Blake and Washington Irving knew of Sleepy Hollow. I'm going to skip a part here. Still, I got one thing from my education. One stag night when the tired tout's bootleg sold too well for what it was, four poisoned drunks lay writhing in the stern on the lower deck in their own spew, and one, half dead but groaning, green in his sweat, lay choking and dry heaving, his pump broken, while from the deck above, girls clattered, the pimp spieled, and the crowd raved. Dixon came after me with the tout. "Hey, kid, got a good stomach?" Dixon said. "Yeah, sure," I told him, honored. "It's a dirty job." "What isn't?" "$5," said the tout. "$5. Here, Johnny, $5 cash and you can hold it. My God, the guy could die." And passed the five to Dixon, who spread it open with both hands to let me see it before he put it away. "And a deuce from me if you'll do it," he tacked on, taking my greedy silence for resistance. "Who do I kill?" I said, taking the line from George Raft, probably. "Look, kid, it's legal. You save a guy," the tout said in a spout. "Lay off," said Dixon, and putting his hand on my shoulder, he walked me off two paces. "It's like this. The guy's choked full of rot gut and can't heave it. I tried to stick my fingers down his throat to get him started, but I just can't make it. Kid," he said, "it takes guts I ain't got. You got the guts to try?" And there I was, with a chance to have more guts than the first mate, and $7 to boot. "Which guy?" I said, only for something to say. I knew already. "That groaner by the winch. I got a fid to jam between his teeth." You know what a fid is? It's a piece of hard wood, long, and comes to a point for being passed through, for splicing rope. And he'd put the thick end of the fid in the man's teeth to keep him from biting down, taking off a finger. "I got a fid to jam between his teeth if you'll reach in and stick your fingers down his throat." We raised him half sitting with his head back on the chains, and Dixon got the thick end of the fid jammed into his teeth on one side. "Let's go, kid," he screamed, almost as green as the half corpse that had begun to tremble like a fish thrown on the deck, not dead yet, though too dead to buck again. But when I touched the slime that might have been his tongue, I couldn't make it. "Dixon, I can't do it," I said. "Do it." "Well, damn your eyes, you said you would. Now put up, or by God, I'll heave you over." "Wait a minute," I said, catching my education by the tail. "Can you hold him there a minute? If he lives, now where the hell you going?" "I'll be right back," I called, already going. "I'll be right back." I ran for the locker, grabbed the feather duster, and ran back, snatching out the grimiest feather, took out my knife, peeled off all but the tip, then fished his throat with it, twirling the stem till I felt him knotting up. "Evo!" I shouted for Bacchus to remember I remembered, not knowing till later that I mispronounced it Evo, not giving Bacchus all his syllables. "Heave ho it is," roared Dixon, and ducked aside as the corpse spouted. "There, by God, she blows." And blow she did. I've never seen a man that dirty and still alive. Except maybe the tout clapping me on the shoulder. "You did it, kid. By God, you did it. Johnny, didn't he do it?" Dixon wiped his hands on the drunk's back where he had twisted and sprawled over the winch drum. What reflex is it turns a dead man over to let him retch face down? And fished the five out of his pocket. "Where'd you learn that trick?" he said as I took the money and waited for more. I could have told him Mitri Meritskovsky, Julian the Apostate, but it wasn't on Miss Blake's list and certainly not on his. "How about the other deuce?" I said instead. He was holding the feather duster by the handle and turning it in his wrist to inspect it from all sides and looking down into its head of fuzz. "What's this thing doing on a ship?" he said. "Waiting for Romans," I told him, guessing his game but hoping to play him off. "That's history, Dixon. When a man went to a banquet and stuffed himself, he'd head for a men's room called a vomitorium, tickle his throat with a feather, do an upchuck, and then start over. How about that deuce?" "If you're so smart, then you can figure out," I said, "if you used your fingers." "Hey," said the tout, "if you ain't paying up, get back my fin. If you can welch on this punk kid, then I can." "Go peddle your sewer sweat," Dixon said. "Here, kid, you earned it right enough. Go buy yourself more education." And stuffed into my pocket a crumple I unfolded into one bill. You see, you always have to save what you can in those days. While he went forward, shoving the tout away. $6 then. One short, but the first cash my education ever paid, and that from off the reading list, though of the empire, if not the kingdom. Meanwhile, the hat passed, the crowd's roar signaling, the pomade gorilla came from the ladies and pushed up the stairs from his own vomitorium to the orgy where low sisters of Meretricus on Esti waited to mount their table through lit smoke into my nose-to-the-window education, one deck below the captain's Yankee eye on watch for the harbor cruiser and the tide, bearing off Thompson Island to the left, Deer Island to the right, and dead ahead Boston's night glow spindled like two mists, one on the flood-lit needle of Bunker Hill, one on the Custom House, both shimmering out to sit the waters of Babylon off Boston, whose dented cup, an original Paul Revere fallen from hand to hand, I drained like the kings of fornication, mad for dirty wine and for the kingdom's opening like a book.